Hi, and welcome to Gen Extemporaneous. This is a podcast where I come up with an idea, I do some research, I grab a bottle of wine, I bring everything to Mark, and he pontificates. Today, we are beginning a multi-episode arc that explores the concept of fandom. As long-term listeners know, we have been fascinated by the way fandoms operate, in particular the Gen X fandom surrounding a 23-year-old TikTok creator, which goes by the tone-deaf appellation Whitey Nation. Our interest in fandom has only grown over time, and recently I've come across academics who study anti-fandom and how it functions as a part of the audience ecosystem. In this episode, we are going to discuss fandom studies generally, what fandom was, and compare it to what it has become. Future episodes are going to dig deeper into fans and anti-fans in theory and also in practice, using the Willverse as our model. Thanks for listening to us each week. If you do like us, we hope you will share us with a friend. Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso. Important programming note, the role of bottle of wine will today be played by ginger beer.
That's right.
And that's alcohol-free ginger beer.
It's alcohol-free.
All right, what's happening? What are we doing here tonight? What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
So what I thought we would do, you know what we're going to be discussing, and we have talked this through a little bit on just previously, you and I. And honestly, it's a subject that we return to
barely talk about anything else.
No, that's not true. Multiple times we've come back to this conversation, because of that, because we are kind of embedded in the test case that we will eventually be talking about and sort of like reflecting back on. And it pretty much, honestly, throughout the episodes, all of the episodes, we'll probably be referencing that fandom, the
Willverse. It's our microcosm.
It is, okay, but we have been observing it for 3 years. Yeah. And listeners, if you're new to the podcast, you can go back and hear it starting episode 53. It's from Tiger Beat to Tiger King, The Rise of a Gen X Fandom.
Greatest title of all time.
And if you want to get caught up with who that is, you can kind of go back and listen to that if you're interested.
You should be.
And then, but throughout all of these episodes, we'll kind of be referring back to that. So since we have not got complete distance, we have not been just outside observers.
Your disclaimer?
It is. Well, I'm announcing our bias. And I thought that we would talk a little bit about our bias and why do you think and why do I think that I am able to step back and you are able to step back and provide.
Because I'm a robot.
Some kind of objective position.
Yeah, I don't have any emotions at all. So
Yeah, Mark. Okay, so for me, after we did the initial sort of distance study and then I was interviewing people in the fandom, I became more embedded in the fandom. To the extent that I belonged to several chat groups that were with people who were at various stages of their journey in
the fanosity of things,
their fan life. And I ended up with quite a number of people who heartily, heartily dislike me in the fandom.
And I was only very tangentially involved. And I have even more people, I think, that heartily dislike me.
If you do have more, I'm catching up.
Yeah, good. Good. That's a lead I'm happy to relinquish. Those people are crazy.
I am dubbed in the fandom by the fans, by certain of the fans, not all the fans, but certain of the fans as a troll. You as well, troll. Yeah. Many of my close friends, people who've become friends of mine that I met through this process, they are also believed to be trolls. I would say that that's inaccurate. I don't believe that I am a troll. I don't believe that you troll them.
I have trolled people, but see, I troll pretty much anybody that I think is A, deserving of it, and B, has shown their ass, right?
Yeah, let's describe what you do.
Oh, I make fun of them.
You make fun of them. Right.
But I don't do
you're not doing ad hom attacks. Well, sometimes you are, but it's usually around their intelligence that you'll say you're a dumbass.
But I don't go around making memes. Like, I don't have that kind of spare time, or if I did, I would spend it doing something else. Mm-hmm. I'm not infiltrating chat groups or spying on them in any way or sending them shit through the mail or threatening their dogs, nothing like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'll troll people that I think are or they deserve it. Like, they're punching down, so I punch them.
You are doing it with your own account. You're hiding behind an anonymous account.
Yeah, I don't have any other accounts other than the podcast account.
So I don't consider what I do trolling. What I will do is if somebody comes at me, I'm going to poke holes or try to in what they have to say. And I don't always do it in a kind and gentle way. Sometimes.
No, but you're definitely much nicer.
I'm much nicer, but I tend to kind of humor them until I reveal the absolute frailty.
Somebody will say to you, they're like, Christina, you are the worst human in the world, and I hope you die in the fire. And you're like, that's interesting. Say more. Let's pull that thread, shall we?
Yeah, let's discuss that. What I do take offense to is, well, as always, this is the thing that I find very offensive in the fandom is the policing of the fandom.
Yeah.
And I would find that offensive in any fandom. Anything that I belong to where I see people trying to
gatekeep
or squash other people's opinions or shame people for having opinions or things that they like. That bothers me. So I have, honestly, critique of the fans, but I also have quite a bit of critique for the anti-fans in the Willverse audience. So those are our biases. Here's what I know that I can do. I feel like I spent enough time not being enmeshed in the fandom that I can step back with a few, and even people that I really dislike, I think I can be empathetic to, and we'll get there. So
yeah. And just to be clear, here are my biases. I find a lot of their behavior dumb, and I have a hard time overlooking that. I was sent a plastic middle finger in the mail. I was sent a t-shirt insulting the size of my manhood. And I've been sent a cease and desist letter, which is hanging on the wall over here to my left. And I had my dog's life threatened.
And yours.
Oh, and mine. Well, I don't care about mine, but Mozart, come on.
All of that was pretty much before.
That's all part of the fandom.
Yeah. Right?
And the middle finger and t-shirt were not that long.
No, that wasn't. That was a year ago now.
Yeah. So anyway, those are my biases, but, you know, I can still speak truth. Don't worry. Don't worry, you guys.
It's going to be okay, you guys. there's actually precedent for the academics who are studying a fandom for them to actually be a part of a fandom or be a part of fandom and understand fandom. So
yeah.
We're not alone in doing what we're doing. Okay.
Is there a support group of some sort?
I would like to start out, as we often do, looking at this from a sort of a 10,000-foot perspective, and then we're going to just continue to narrow and narrow and narrow and get more and more specific. I want to first situate everybody in the academic universe that this
holy cow
kind of discussion sits.
Please lay it on.
We are not in that universe. We are people who are observing what they do and learning about what they do and trying to apply it to our situation.
Isn't that what they do as well?
Well, then we're a part of that universe.
Hell yeah. Professor Snedeker, what's up?
All right. So fandom studies, I found out recently, is a thing.
Yeah.
And I thought, holy smokes, there's something that is actually less useful
than philosophy and history.
Applicable than philosophy or history. How did I miss studying this? This would have been a perfect
major for me. I am certain it was not available during your college
years. No, it was. Yeah, of course it was. Yeah, yeah.
Where?
90s. So media studies.
Was it like Vassar or?
No. You could do it in, it says, well, and this is a good question and a great segue.
Thank you.
It's an offshoot of media studies or like mass comm. So do you know what media studies is or mass comm?
I assume that they study things like broadcast, television and movies and radio and newspaper and just all the ways that we communicate through the fourth estate, right?
So, yes. So you're exactly correct. Mm. They look at different things, including content, including the history of media, and obviously if you're someone who's studying newspapers, you can go way back in history, right?
Right.
But also includes broadcast and things like that, radio, any way that media film, any way that media gets to people. because what they're really interested in is the effect that various media have on communities, on individuals.
Right.
So, you know, something that you might study in mass comm would be like propaganda and how, right. how propaganda works. We just talked about propaganda in documentaries last week.
Now, are these majors mostly scholarship athletes? No,
what?
It's legitimate.
Holy cow. I wanted to be a mass comm. I wanted to go into mass comm. Thank in fact, God when I was younger, when I was in my teens, I did journalism. I was.
Yeah, journalism's better.
Well, that is mass comm.
Yeah, mass comm is mass comm.
Communications and mass comm go kind of hand in hand, and journalism falls under that.
Yeah.
All right. So there are a variety of disciplines, like methodology, that this field of study draws upon. So do you want to take a guess at some of the things that inform media studies?
So, of course, there's going to be psychology, sociology, history,
yep.
Philosophy, government, maybe.
Poli-sci, yep. Legal, yep. Lit theory, cultural studies, rhetoric.
All that stuff
is our fields.
Which English.
Lit crit.
Is that how we say it now?
Yeah, lit theory.
We're that familiar with it. We just say lit crit.
Of course. I had one or two English classes sure in did. College. I feel perfectly comfortable using the lingo.
You're fine just dropping
lingo.
It down to lit crit?
Yes.
Okay.
No, of course we can use that term. What we understand is contemporary media studies emerged in the mid-20th century, but it had roots, and I was really interested to find this out because as an anthropology minor, there was some sociology that I had to do. And so this was interesting. I was kind of familiar with this, but not completely. It has its roots in the Chicago School, which is the school of sociology. Its golden age was between 1915 and 1935.
Wasn't that the golden age of everything?
Kind of.
Pretty much.
Well, post-war. I would say the post-World War I.
Well, that was the golden age of mustard gas. trenches.
All right. So their work is the first major focus on was called urban sociology.
Okay.
So they were looking at these kind of like tight-knit communities.
Right.
And it was really, a lot of it was based on criminal activity and juvenile delinquency. And
sure.
They did demographic maps and they plotted.
I saw The Godfather.
Okay.
I know what's up.
All right. Okay. Kind of for one of the first times, people were combining theory because they were theorizing on what would cause the problems and then also theorizing on what would fix the problems. Yeah. but it combines theory and ethnographic field work. So they were
couldn't
in the
we have
field.
Saved them a little bit of time and gone, poverty, money. That's what would fix it.
Well, what they, and this, all of a sudden my radar went up because always when we're talking about things like fandom and cults and things like that, that we're underpinning that or kind of overarching that, however you want to look at it, is the crisis of meaning.
Yes.
Right. That we've returned to again and again.
Right.
And really what this school uncovered was that in certain areas where there were higher rates of crime or whatever, or juvenile delinquency, it was because in those areas, generally,
they were going through it.
Things were breaking down, different things that would have helped them, like, you know, boys and girls. I'm making this up, some kind of community building thing that would have been sponsored by the government, those were all breaking down. Or if they had them, they didn't work quite, they weren't well funded enough.
Were an ethnic group that were excluded from those types of things.
Right, right. So any and all of those things. So they were able to combine that theory and that study of how that worked. And they believed that the natural environment in which a community is a major factor in shaping human behavior.
Okay.
It's really interesting kind of stuff that they were thinking about. And as I said, they were starting to think about ways to fix it. Like, what could we do to fix these issues? And what they really felt And this was so optimistic, and I was surprised to read this. They felt that the world was on the edge of becoming a true democracy.
Oh, no way.
And that one of the ways that that was actually going to happen was to improve communication, and thereby improving communication, we would naturally become more empathetic to other people.
You would think.
And that we would also be known to others, that okay. we would yeah. empathize, and then we would become known and know others that were previously unlike ourselves.
Seems reasonable.
Well,
but
does
it didn't
though?
Go that way.
No, it doesn't go that way. Anytime you improve communication, it seems that things go worse and worse. Look at the internet.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we're going to get to in our discussion about fandoms is the role of the internet in how this all plays out.
I'm down for that.
So as the century progresses, media studies sort of evolves. And so then the mid-century on, you get different kinds. We talked about propaganda studies.
Yes.
They start to really think about the effects that media has on an audience. And by the 70s, it's less about how the media affects the audience. It's more about how the audience uses and the sort of the uses and gratifications. It's called the uses and gratifications model. In other words, how do audiences make sense of media, and why do audiences enjoy media? So
okay.
that's really in the 1970s how right. that.
And they did that so that they could make better movies?
Well, you know, or to try and understand.
Control the plebs?
Well, just understand. Well, right. It's almost like that. It made me think of the generations thing. How generation segmentation is a marketing thing.
It is.
A lot of this could be applied to marketing.
Oh, I'm sure it was. And is.
And is. Right? Because
for sure.
you know what the audience wants the media for. Yeah. And then you tick
give
those boxes.
Them. Give it to them mm-hmm. in a inexpensive way.
Maybe, yeah. All right. So from media studies, you go deep, you know, so you narrow down a little bit and you get into fan studies. Fan studies has gone through three waves by this time. We are in currently the third wave of fan studies. But fan studies analyzes fans, fandoms, the culture of fandoms, fan activities, and fan works.
Okay.
So all these things that fans do.
They do a lot of stuff. They do a lot of stuff.
They do. Aren't you surprised? Interacting with fandoms as we have been, hasn't that been a surprise to you how much people do?
I mean, it consumes a larger chunk of their day than I would have guessed.
Right.
Because it's almost like they take on a part-time job. Okay, I'm going to be Taylor Swift. I'm going to be a Swifty, right? Mm-hmm. So I got to post on some fan boards. I got some memes to put up. Mm-hmm. I got some slash fic going on, you know, whatever.
I need I need to be in contact with people on Twitter.
Yeah.
I need to do lives
right.
where we talk about things.
I got to run around. I got to diss some other singers, you know, whatever it
well,
takes.
Well, that may be, but maybe you're just a fan that enjoys fanning
well,
and you're doing
depends.
All of these things.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So here's where we talk about the theory that informs fan studies, because the theory that informs fan studies is very, very interesting to me.
All right. Well, lay it on me.
So,
and I'll tell you if it's interesting to me.
Feminist theory.
Okay.
Queer theory.
Yes.
Internet theory and legal theory.
Internet theory? What mm-hmm. is that?
It's a focus on everyday uses and effects of the internet.
Okay.
One of the other things that fan studies does, or scholars who are studying fans, they look at the tropes. And largely these tropes exist in maybe in art, but certainly in fanfic.
So we're talking now about fan products.
Yeah,
right?
Fan products. So this is how, so they would look at fan works, and they would explore the activities that they're doing and then how they're applying tropes to those
right.
activities.
So 95% of it, mm-hmm. slash fic.
Slash. Okay, so what is slash fan fiction for those who do not know?
Slash fic is a fiction with a romantic or sexual encounter between two members of the fictional or fan universe that you're discussing. Typically, often it's male-male, female-female, or
mm-hmm. same-sex.
Same-sex or, you know, blend of queer people. So, and then they just write fiction about them having sex with each other.
Yeah, and they're sexy. They're, well, they're erotic. Now, did you know
fans? Don't assume that I know a lot about this.
There's a lot of fan studies stuff that goes back really to Star Trek and the fluorescence of the Trekkie fandom.
Yeah, because it was one of the early nerd fandoms, right, where they're extremely devoted and immersed in that universe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Star Trek inspired this very passionate fan base. And it was this fairly well-constructed universe, mm-hmm. which I think often helps with the fan art mm-hmm. community, where it has this, you know, fairly well-constructed universe. There's a lot that they can do within that universe, mm-hmm. a lot of characters that appeal to them, and mm-hmm. then there's a structure around it, like the Federation or, mm-hmm. you know, Klingon homeworld or whatever it is. So, yeah, they wrote a lot of fan fiction.
And they use fanzines to communicate a lot of this stuff.
Right, and they weren't getting as much content directly from Gene Roddenberry.
So they had to create it themselves.
Right. It was like three seasons, you know, and that was like it.
Yeah. Until they went into the renaissance of all the various iterations. Correct. All right. So that's one. Another one is Hurt Comfort. Do you know what this genre is all about?
Isn't that have to do with our last podcast, Army Hammer?
It's a genre of fan fiction that focuses on a pair of characters.
Yeah.
And one of the characters is somehow hurt.
Yes. Like, say,
emotionally or physically or
whatever.
For
example, he's trapped in a room filling with radiation and he presses his hand up against the glass.
Oh, my God.
And says, you know, Jim, you were always my friend.
Oh, my God. Okay. And another character who's providing comfort or helping to fix the character. So just as any genre of fanfic, it can be equally good or bad.
Was there Little House on the Prairie fanfic?
Probably there it exists.
You would think so, right?
Well, now it would, but it would be retroactive, right, I would imagine.
Right. I'm like trying
although
to think.
There might have been people who read the books originally and then did, who knows what people were doing.
Who knows what people get up to.
Their own time.
Yeah.
All right. And then the final one, and you talk about this one a lot, is the final one that I've put here, though certainly not exhaustive list, but you talk about this a lot, is the Mary Sue.
Right, which is a work of fiction that an author has constructed where the main character is really invincible, right? Mm-hmm. They're the best looking, they're always good at stuff, mm-hmm. they're the hero, mm-hmm. they're smart, they're, you know, everybody loves them, mm-hmm. they get the boy or the girl or whoever it is they're romantically interested in, mm-hmm. and it just all goes their way.
Right. All right, so
it's horrible literature, by
exactly
the way.
Exactly it. But what it generally is a projection. It's certainly an avatar for the author. So when women write these, Mary Sue, and this name comes from a Star Trek fanfic.
Yeah.
Generally, these are female characters who are exotically beautiful, often having an unusual hair or eye color.
Of course.
And a similarly cool and exotic name. Except for Mary Sue, I don't know. She's exceptionally talented in a plausibly wide variety of areas and may possess skills that are rare or non-existent in the canon setting. So she's bringing in all kinds of extra stuff.
It's like, our new ensign can fly and shoot laser beams from her eyeballs.
She also lacks any realistic or at least story relevant character flaws.
Right.
Either that or her flaws are obviously meant to be endearing.
Humble bragging.
Yeah, like, oh, she's so perfect.
Yeah, she's
what
so
a flaw.
She just cares too much. It's like being in a job interview, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
What is your major flaw? Well, I'm Mary Sue. So, you know,
exactly.
You can imagine.
So this is a part of it. This is something that they look at when they're looking at fan behavior and fan activities. Fan studies in and of itself is pretty new. It really kind of gets real traction in the 1980s. And that's when it shifted from the effects of media on fans to fan works. As I mentioned, it was three waves so far, and we're in the third wave, but 1980s, academics looked at these communities as subcultural, and they opted for their own sort of interpretation,
right,
these communities. And then it reacted to or viewed the audience as in a lesser power position they started to look at how fandoms were belittled.
Like I just did with the Star Trek fans. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or that media, when media was talking about fangirls or fandoms, the media itself would kind of be critical of it.
And they kind of look down their nose at it.
Yeah, right? A little bit.
Like, oh, these girls screaming for the Beatles, you know, how silly. Or these nerds talking about Star Trek or Star Wars or Dungeons and Dragons or whatever it is. Yeah.
These studies, so this is the initial wave, they focus mainly, completely on the very active fans. So almost what we would have called in our last episode, stans. So they're looking at stans.
Super fans.
But they're not looking at the casual fan or the lurker. So those are segments of the society the community that they just didn't imagine to exist, right? Or imagine to be important to what they were doing.
Right. Well, they're not as interesting, right? Because they don't act crazy.
And this marks the advent of what we could call ourselves, which is the ACAFAN. Which means an academic who is embedded, because remember, we're professors for this episode.
That's right.
That are embedded in the fandom, either because they are a part of that fandom or they understand fandom because they are a part of some fandom.
Yeah.
Right. And so then they are uniquely, in some ways, qualified, but you
also somewhat disqualified because of their bias.
They're biased, right? So as long as they are open with their bias, then.
Like, I think you could get an interesting essay from a Swiftie, assuming that they're, you know, properly trained and educated.
Yeah.
But would you get a truthful or a wholly truthful essay from them? I suspect that they might tend, not necessarily, but they might tend to gloss over some of the less attractive facets of the fandom, right? Because they're part of it.
At least of the fandom that there exists. Okay, so understanding, and we saw this happen. Mm-hmm. Fandoms may start out as a bigger thing, but as time goes on, they get into, it's almost like concentric circles, or they might be in separate circles within a wider
They tend footprint. To start to segment themselves.
Yes.
And
so
the various groups sort of, and this is the way I put it, they distill, mm-hmm. you know, their essence, and they become, if they're a super fan, over time they tend to, I think, become more ultra, mm-hmm. you know, assuming they stay in the fandom.
So another way you could look at it is that those segments are the ones on the outside layers or outside ends of the bell curve, mm-hmm. and then the majority of people in the center are, you know, pretty normal level fans.
Yeah, but they also strike me as the more transient of the
middle, the ones in the middle of
the
bell.
They're more likely to come and go.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But what to your back to your point about the ACAFAN, they may be in one type of segment of the fandom and therefore have a bias and think, well, the way that we fan is the right way to fan. But that doesn't mean that they can't see the way others are fanning.
No, but they might
be able to. They could
be prejudiced
against some of them, but maybe not. I mean, if they're academics, hopefully they learn.
We'll evaluate that on a case-by-case basis,
how to put their bias aside. Okay, so as time goes on, media initially, and we all know this, those of us of Gen X age and millennial age understand that there was a different way of consuming media earlier on in our lives. It was broadcasting, which is going to a broad audience from a few sources to a very big, broad audience.
You have five channels and everybody's watching the same show at the same time.
Right.
Going to the same movies, et cetera.
And so then as time goes on, you start to see narrow casting start to happen.
Right.
And at this point in sharing media, in television history, let's say, mm-hmm. the dedicated fan became an important customer to which the media was marketed.
You know, I think even before the internet, you saw some of that with the explosion of cable channels.
Exactly. Well, that's what they're talking about, right?
Because so we start off, we have, you know, the major networks, you have PBS for when they're running their mm-hmm. telethon and, you know, Monty Python is on. And you got HBO, right? So you get some movies. But then once MTV hits, it seems like things start to proliferate and you get things like BET and Univision and Sci-Fi Channel and, you know, the Discovery Channel and TLC and all these things, which are much more narrowly tailored to a niche audience.
Right. So now people start studying instead of just their fandom.
Yeah.
Society is judging these people on the object of what they are fanning for. So, so sort of what is the object of their interest and what does that interest then imply about those
people?
It's a
stereotype of those fans.
Right. As a community. So the second wave of fan studies focuses on parallels between fan cultures and mass social and cultural hierarchies. So really fan studies is
a microcosm of our world.
Going back to the Chicago school, if you think about that line from Chicago school to fan studies, you can see how they're doing that, right? Like Chicago school is looking, those are sociologists looking at actual demographic communities in the in the sense of their geographical communities. Right. Fan studies are still looking at communities.
But no longer bounded by geography.
Right.
Bounded by media.
Media and interest, right? And shared interest.
Yes.
And you know how when we talked about the crisis of meaning, again, remember the Chicago school is looking at how structures are breaking down and therefore causing a certain amount of juvenile delinquency or whatever it is, crime, whatever. Fan studies might be able to look at it from the perspective of, well, is this community serving the purpose of having something that people are coalescing around?
Right.
And therefore, I mean, I don't know, keeping them out of trouble, not necessarily keeping them out of trouble, but what does it say?
It's giving them a social outlet.
Yeah.
Demented and sad, but social.
Exactly. All right. So the current wave, so then things move on. The current wave of fan studies focuses both on individual motivations and gratification of fandom and the wider social structures that fandom is tied to. The examination of fandom is aimed at giving insight into modern life.
Yeah.
So it's really building off of what they were doing in the second wave and sort of saying, okay, well now how is this, what does this tell us about society in general?
Right.
The third wave focuses on fandom as a community. The structure aids in negotiation of how exactly fans attempt to accrue and implement power and if they are in fact successful.
Power? Oh, you mean like within the fandom?
Having
a certain amount of authority and position.
Authority and status.
Status, that's my go-to.
I know that is. So, you know, I mean, all of this is really in line with what we've talked about at length in previous episodes about the Willverse. That's the fandom studies. So what is it that they're studying? What is a fandom? Really what a fandom is an audience.
Okay.
Within this sort of big thing of audience, there are different kinds of consumers of a media. It's often talked about in terms of viewer because they're talking a lot about television or film or whatever, but it could be anything. So I'm going to use, it could be readers, it could be listeners to music, it could be viewers of not television series, but of movies or of creators' work on TikTok or whatever it is. All right. So within the audience as a whole, there are casual viewers.
Fucking casuals. That's what we call it in gamers.
All right.
So if you're a gamer and like you're hardcore, like, okay, back in the day, I used to play World of Warcraft. Mm-hmm. I considered myself pretty hardcore, right? I was raiding, you know, I got my tier set, whatever. You don't need to know what any of that stuff is.
Mark was like a top player. He was a highly ranked player.
I was okay.
So embarrassing.
Yes, it was. God. No, you should be proud. But then you, the people who just show up and go, you know, they're just playing the game, you know, they've just introduced to the game, they don't know anything about it, or they play like once a week or something. And the kind of the elite higher level players refer to them as fucking casuals.
Right.
So, and we disdain.
With disdain.
Efforts.
Okay. Yes. So these are casual viewers. And so, and also we didn't neglect it to say, but video games, are media, comic books would be media.
No doubt.
So, all right. So casual viewers, they like it. But they're not engaging, as you said. They're not necessarily engaging.
They're not doing the hard work. Let's just say that.
With regularity.
Right.
So, for instance, they may be somebody who would watch Star Trek, but right. they would never consider themselves to be Trekkies.
They're not going to a con. Mm-mm. They're not learning Klingon in their free time.
No.
You know.
They may look at articles. So they could might. Go and look at articles. If they came across them, they might read them. In fact, they might even seek them out. But, and they might go to or watch ancillary media about it. Like an interview comes on, they might watch that. Right. Or they might go and.
Shatner's on SNL, let's go watch that.
Yeah. And they, or they might watch, for instance, an iteration of Star Trek, right? They might go, well, I like that one. Well, I'll check out the other one. We'll they might become interested in
next
that.
Next generation is all
but
about.
They're not necessarily going to seek it out. They may, but they might not.
It's not their thing. I mean, they like it, but they're not in that heavily invested.
And
in
this
it.
Is important. It's rare that they would engage with others about it. So
yeah, they're not going online chit-chatting about it. They might, you know, if their friend said, hey, did you watch Star Trek last night? And they're like, yeah, it's pretty good. They're like, okay.
Yeah. Or they might say, oh, you know, I watched this TV show. It was pretty good, right? Yeah.
Like it's the Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. So then you get fans who are serious viewers. So now you wanted to do one that was like, an extra level.
Sure.
So you wanted to do four levels, but I say that there's three. So I'll tell you how fans are described.
I think you have to
defined.
Bifurcate the top level.
All right. So fans are serious viewers or consumers of media, whichever it is, whichever media it is, that are very invested in it.
Yes.
They might seek out additional ways to engage with the universe. They would self-define as a fan of that particular media. So for instance, they would call themselves Trekkies. They might go to cons. They definitely would be consuming articles about it. They might go to cons. They might engage in writing fanfic or for fanzines, and they might organize or become involved with fan clubs.
They might have merch. They might wear that merch in appropriate times.
All right. So what would you then call a stan?
That's someone who is just, it's their life.
It's their complete identity.
Right. They're at the con. They're asking William Shatner what the combination is to the safe, right? Mm-hmm. They're following the dead across the country for a year.
Right.
Tom. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, they live and breathe that fandom. It's really the central defining characteristic of their existence.
So I would say that if you think about them with fans, instead of just being the fan that joins a fan club, these are the fans that make and run the fan club.
I would say that's definitely correct.
These are the fans who might be like stalkers. You get fans.
Yeah.
The fans might go to a con and meet them.
Yeah.
These kinds of stans are the ones who think that they have
I heard Leonard Nimoy is staying at the Hilton.
Yeah,
let's go over to the Hilton.
Right, right. So these are the ones that are going to try and seek them out.
Right, but you can just say that that's just an extreme version of your, you know, top level fan.
Right.
I think there's a difference between fans and stans, but you know, it's quibbling. I mean, that's what academia is all about.
It's
just
semantic.
Arguing about categorization.
Yeah. All right. All right. So there's another group of fans, and this has become kind of a new and interesting segment of fan studies, and that is to study anti-fans.
Yeah.
So
now those, I think they existed on some level, you know, previous to the internet age, for example. Like, I think there were, you know, there's always a reaction against whatever super
there
popular.
There is, and we'll talk about
like,
how
I hate the Beatles, they're so overrated, whatever, even though they're awesome.
Right.
But I don't think there was really a way for them to unite as a community.
Well, we'll talk about what that the landscape of that community was in just a minute. But anti-fans, for those who do not know
and can't figure it out from the etymology of the word,
they don't like the media.
Right.
But they're not indifferent to it. It's not they can scroll by if somebody is having a fun time talking about the media. They have to engage and tell those people they're wrong for liking the media.
Right.
You know, they might engage negatively with fans.
Jar Jar Binks is living rent-free in their head.
Exactly. They might engage in hate watching.
Yeah.
And I'll admit it now. I'm an anti-fan of the new seasons or the new the reboot of Sex and the City.
Yeah.
And it's, to me, so far removed from what it was and so weird and badly acted. Like,
suddenly, you're talking to somebody who thinks that's pretty accurate description of the original
suddenly
series.
You can't believe that these women are even these women. Yeah. Like, they've been
not
these
real.
Like the characters have become just caricatures.
Yeah.
And it's hard to connect at all with any of them. And they're missing Samantha. And I think that Samantha is a key to understanding why all of that worked in the first place. But I can't not watch this.
Really? Because I have no problem not watching it.
I'm
must so good
watch,
at not
and you
watching
know
it.
I do, because
I
watch it and then I tell
you
the next
about it, and I'm
day
like,
that why does it so
I,
bad?
I don't care. But she tells me anyway.
I engage with this because
she imposes
I hate
her
it.
Opinion on this show that I don't care about.
Now, what I don't do is go around and engage with fans of it and try and tell them not to like it. I recognize it, so I'm kind of a closet anti-fan for that.
Right.
For that show, but I also read what other people say where they love it so much, and I'm like, I don't get it.
But you don't tell them that they're
but
wrong.
But I don't mock it. No.
You don't go to RSITC. And say, you guys are morons for watching this show. Mm-mm. It sucks.
Mm-mm-mm. No, I don't. Okay. You can have an anti-fan who is also a fan. So here's how that might look.
How does that work?
All right. So how that might look is you're a purist of a segment of whatever it is. So let's say it's Star Trek again, and you like the first series, but you don't like Next Generation.
Oh, what is wrong with you? That's the best one.
It is the best one.
Okay. But you're like Deep Space Nine, you know, whatever, and you hate it.
And you hate it, or you hate every other one except that one, or you hate,
you know who's,
or you love all of them except that one.
And you know we've talked about this the most. The fandom that hates the universe that they live in more than any other fandom, who is it?
Star Wars.
They hate Star, like aunties in Star Wars, love the idea of Star Wars, hate every single Star Wars except maybe Empire.
Right.
They just hate all Star Wars.
So
it's crazy.
And that's a segmentation of it. So there might be antis who feel disgruntled by the way a showrunner navigates the universe.
For sure.
Star Wars is a great example. But then also, as I said, purists who have beef with other fans. So they're gatekeeping. Yeah. They're gatekeeping what they believe a true fan is, and they'll then have beef not only with people who, so they're fighting with aunties who don't like the media, but they're also fighting they're fighting with Star Wars fans if they're Star Trek fans, but they're also fighting with Next Generation fans or fighting with whatever. So they are antis who are having a multi-front war sometimes.
Yeah. Often you'll see it where there's an adaptation.
Where there's an adaptation. And
from a book to a TV show, book to a movie,
right.
TV show to a movie, vice versa, whatever. And some segment of that population, well, people are going to be divided over which one's better.
Which one is truer. We exist in another fandom.
We do.
With our podcast, Vampire Insider, where that is.
That's a big deal.
That's actually a thing.
Yeah.
It's,
There's book purists.
Book purists, there are people who like the movie better than anything.
Which is insane. There are people who just only have consumed the TV show and, you know, don't want to hear about the movie or the book or anything. But those.
And there are people who have read the books, like the show, but don't like elements of how the showrunners are running the show.
Right.
They don't like how they have to handle certain characters. So it's a very rich universe. Going back to when we consume media through broadcast, there's an author, Emma Jane, who has an essay called Should Anti-Fan Studies Be Renewed for Another Season? And she calls this the legacy media orientation.
All right. Lay it on me.
Okay. In the legacy media orientation, the producer of the text was usually, and here again, when I'm saying text
content,
or media,
whatever.
I mean, whatever it is, it's a TV show, it's a movie, whatever. But the producer of that was usually a behemoth production company broadcasting on its own terms, and the consumer, the fan, was just the part of a really broad audience.
Right.
And as such, it was really easy to know who was who. Like, you knew who the viewer, the consumer was, you knew who the producer was, you knew within the fandom who the fan was and who the anti-fan was, and you understood that there were just a lot of very casual viewers also
Of course, yeah.
that were in there. If there's issues or discontent, anybody observing that would be like, well, it's David going up against Goliath, the producers being Goliath, obviously, and the fan. So if the fan is not happy with how the show is going, they're going to punch up. They're not bullying a big production company. They can't because they have no authority
or power.
They'll
write an angry letter.
Or they'll complain at a con or whatever, you know. And if they are arguing with other fans because of the way communication worked at the time, so you know, during really the broadcasting time, it would have been a more lateral cultural, it would be like a discourse, intellectual discourse, and a lot of that would happen face to face because you'd see, it would happen at cons.
Dial a random phone number and start yelling at him about Star Trek.
Right. You know. Hey, do you listen to, do you watch Star Trek?
Give me a phone number in Decatur. I'm calling someone. What's wrong with you? Who's the best captain? Why is it Kirk?
So there was, like I said, so it's punching up, it's lateral or even just kind of friendly discourse, right? So now we're moving to this narrow cast format. And Jane calls into question the nature of what an audience is when she, in her essay that I referenced before. And she starts to say, well, what even is an audience now? Because now an audience isn't just a consumer of the media. The audience member is somebody that producer is targeting. Because remember, it's smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
So they know they have
tailoring content,
and they're trying to find a certain audience for their narrow-casted piece
producers,
of media.
I feel you. That's
and
what we do.
Then the audience member feels maybe like they have a stake in what is going on because they're very clearly, well, I'm paying for this subscription, and I watch my show on this channel.
Better be what I want.
I want my show to be what I want my show to be. So this is a splintered marketplace, and the producers are relying on people to subscribe.
Yeah.
And the fans are going, well, it's on demand. It's on my demand.
They're taking it seriously.
All right. So now there's also another way for fans to communicate. You don't have to go to a con. You don't have to wait until the next day to go to the office and talk about it.
You can live stream that shit.
You can go online immediately or at the time that the show is airing or immediately after, and you can start having discourse with people. And usually, hopefully, it's positive, but it's not always because not only are fans finding ways to enter into discourse on the internet, it's also aunties who are finding ways to discourse on the internet.
Because in the same way that broadcasting created a broad community of people who are consuming this media. So if you're going to have a conversation, chances are you're not talking to someone who's in the exact same market segment as you.
Mm-hmm.
However, online, in the same sense that they're narrow casting to an audience, the community created where these people hang out and talk about this show is also exclusive and tailored to this audience. So you can go to a place on the internet and reliably talk about Firefly or whatever show you want to talk about, and you know you'll get feedback, which is really what I think a lot of people are looking for, right? Mm-hmm. You want feedback and status. And, you know, sometimes you just want to talk about your show, which is totally fine. It's not weird at all, people. But there's a narrow group, and therefore the antis know where to go to
find you too. And there's nowhere. And what's interesting is when I see some of the discourse on internet, it's almost like people kind of roll in and they're going to come in and they're going to tell you how it is. And then they're like, why don't you just go away? Go away where? Yeah. I'm on the internet. Like, I want to still talk about this.
Do I have to turn my computer off?
Go away. Like, they're like, I'm running you out of town. It's weird. And no one ever does go away.
Right.
Even if you block them, then they'll create another account and try and see who you are. So it's a strange flex to go at someone online because their opinion about a piece of media is different than your own.
People get a kind of an inflated sense of importance, I think, sometimes. Yeah. Like they've developed whatever, some level of status in a fandom, and they think that that's actual power, right?
Right.
And that they can now control this space. And I guess in some cases they can if it's their you know, if they control the
Facebook
subreddit
or whatever.
Or whatever. But it does give people this weird sense that they can now command people to behave in a way that they want them to behave.
And they do have authority, because let's say you are a part of a really active, fun subreddit.
Yeah.
And you run afoul of the administrator.
A misstep. And
you're going to get kicked out.
Yeah.
And then you're missing out because you've made friends. I mean, this is not a false community. It is a real community. You do make friends. You form, this sounds a little bit much, but it's kind of true. You form alliances.
Sure.
You have friendships.
Dude, we've done that in fandoms.
Of course. Well, we did in the Willverse, and we'll talk about that. And the Willverse is very small. So it's very easy to see these kind of like status arguments.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
It's fascinating to watch how it happens. Jane says this, there's a blurring of lines between producer and audience. And this is even more interesting, right? Okay. So she says, and I'm quoting at length here, at any given moment, a single person might simultaneously hold many roles, including that of content producer, fact checker, editor, curator, aggregator, broadcaster, publisher, audience member, reviewer, devoted fan, vitriolic anti-fan, citizen surveiller and regulation officer, whistleblower, saboteur, digilante activist.
Digilante.
I know. Hate speech producer, hate speech recipient, lynch mob member, stalker. I mean,
I bet you a lot of those people won't use those terms to describe themselves.
No, stalker, committer of a crime, victim of a crime, or aspects of all things at once. Indeed, at any given moment, people might suddenly find they are circulating as media texts themselves.
These guys must have the longest resumes ever.
But it could be just one person, right? I mean, you go through all of this stuff, and then someone gets a picture of you, and you become a meme. So then you're a piece of media.
I wish.
Mean, the complexity of all of this, Jane says, makes it extremely difficult to determine who and what are playing which roles at any single anti-fan scene or any single scene.
Oh, I wouldn't mind being a meme. Even if it's insulting. Like if they did like they had some dumb picture of me and they said like, you know, I'm not a regular dad, I'm a cool dad, right? And they did like a whole meme on that. I would be okay with that.
Well. All right. So let's drill down a little bit into fan behavior.
All right.
Because that's really what we're getting at here. One way to look at fan behavior and the impact of media on an audience is through the lens, and I mentioned this before, of the uses and gratification theory.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so this was first developed, this theory, in the 1970s, and it basically just helps academics organize how they think about media consumption.
Okay.
So how they're going to look at a community of fandom.
Right.
So in an article on the website mediastudies.com, the author notes, it attempts to explain why we deliberately choose to engage with certain texts. In other words, why do we use the media and what gratifications can they provide? So because it was developed in 1972, I'm like, discovered this. Is this still something that's applied? I have to like talk about this as like as a part of an evolution? Right. Well, it actually is still relevant today. Annabelle Quanhazy, in an article for the Journal of Mass Communication and Journalism, argues that UNG provides a unique perspective on digital media as it stresses the relevance of media in the context of everyday life, examining uses, gratification sought and obtained, and media practices over time. So it still is relevant even in the social media era.
All right, good.
Okay, so what is it? So let's talk about what UNG is.
Use and gratification, is that what it is?
Uses and gratifications model, okay?
Well,
so this was...
The slash fic fans, that's not too hard to figure out which part of that formula they're going after.
Yeah, so the theorists who developed this listed four categories.
Yeah.
So this is how people use and find gratification in media. Diversion.
Totally normal. That's what most people do, I think.
Because people want to be entertained.
Of course. I mean, are you not entertained?
Are you not entertained? It's true. That was media. That
Absolutely.
Was Roman media. Okay. Yeah. Personal relationships.
Yeah. Make friends.
Whether it's, you know, these personal relationships can be with other fans, but it also can be with the media.
Right. The parasocial relationship.
The parasocial relationship.
You and Taylor Swift.
100%. Or yeah. It's like the security of seeing Wink Martindale every week as your show host.
Wink was pretty solid.
Or Richard Dawson sexually assaulting women with impunity.
Less great.
You.
Gene Rayburn liked him.
Yeah, he was good.
He had that little, those long, skinny microphone.
Yeah, so did
doodad.
Wink Martindale.
Yeah, exactly.
Such a funny microphone.
Wink.
God.
Oh, his name is God. Wink, for God's sake.
So it breeds a sense of familiarity and companionship and is an important aspect of personal.
You know where you see a great example of that is when Bob Barker died.
That's
everybody was like, I remember sick days, you know, homesick from school. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, Bob Barker and all the other, you know, then you watch some bullshit daytime talk show or whatever, and then you're stuck with soaps, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But
so this is actually exactly. No, I 100%. I did do that too. You know, I was watching. I had chicken noodle soup.
Of course, you have soup
and saltines.
Soup and Price is Right. You know, whatever. Yeah.
So personal identity, or no? So these are like on the hierarchy of needs too, right? Like what are the basic needs of human beings, right? So and then the other thing, the third one is personal identity.
That's the big one for me, I think, especially as you start looking at the ultra fans, because they are image crafting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want people to know I'm a fan.
Well, it's their brand.
Yeah. Even like sports fans, for example, I am I'm a Bears fan, the Bears, and I wear the jersey all the time.
Wear their kit.
Yeah, exactly. Full kit wankers.
Mm-hmm.
But that becomes who at a certain point, it becomes who they are.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to know me as a Bears fan.
Right. Media also informs to us not only that we self-identify as this is our personal identity as being fans, but it also media feeds to us what our identity should be in the sense that, like, for instance, this is the way that you should talk. This is a cool way to talk. This is a cool way to look. These are cool clothing.
Right. And we did that too. Like, MTV was huge for that.
Right.
So that it showed you what your favorite band dressed like.
And then you
dressed like that.
Amplified that attachment and that identity because you were physically taking on that appearance.
And you're telling the world, hey, I am a Duran Duran fan, as you can tell from my pants, you know?
And my Jazz Oxford.
And my Jazz Oxfords.
All right, so it's also to do with surveillance, which is that people like to know what's happening.
Yeah.
They like to feel like they're authorities in information, and they are the ones holding onto that information and then disseminating that information.
Yes.
So again, this is, you can see where if you are just a casual viewer and you like the show, and then you can go and talk with people around
the
water cooler, and you might have, you know, you might have some, you maybe read an article or something. Super fans, stans are going to be the ones who actually have or claim to have inside information that they then hold on to, and only certain people can get those secret tidbits.
Right.
And, you know, that's them controlling,
gatekeeping
the info. Right.
So I think that idea right there was behind an entire marketing plan by ABC or by NBC, must see TV, right? Because the idea was if you didn't watch Friends and Cheers and whoever the fuck else was on
ER on Thursday, Seinfeld.
Then you wouldn't be in the know when everybody's talking about it around the water cooler the next day.
Right.
So they created this demand for their program.
Well, and gave you some really good programs.
Oh, well, no doubt. I mean, obviously that helps, you know.
Yeah.
But they created this demand for their program by telling you basically it's FOMO, right? You're going to be missing out on these conversations. Everybody else knows what Chandler got up to last night, and you won't.
And then it goes the other way. And what's so interesting is that there are some people who have the information and others who don't, but want the information, but don't want the information from the people who have it. They want the information from the experience of watching the show themselves. And then they'll, instead of just staying off the internet,
they
get angry when people are on the internet talking about it. And they're like, you're giving away spoilers. And
well, maybe don't go into Cheers.
Don't go online.
Yeah, don't go into cheerspoilers.com. Maybe that's not the best place for you.
You got to turn that off. And then they might then say, but I still want to engage in conversation. I just don't want to hear the spoilers or see the spoilers. Well,
watch the show before you engage.
Right,
people.
That's
heart.
You know, that's it. So I actually, what I want to kind of do is take those four things and keep those in mind as we go through this to talk about, you know, like the diversion aspect of it, the personal relationships,
status,
the personal identity, the need identity. For knowledge or surveillance. So I want to kind of pull that thread as we continue on with the rest of these episodes.
Yeah.
And we're going to start getting into more of...
Oh, we're going to spill some tea.
Well, I don't know that we're going to spill some tea, but we're going to get into some more practical examples of how we see some of this playing out. So the next several episodes are going to go like this. We're going to talk about fandom and examples of how fans work and how we see fans interacting, using the Wilverse as the kind of little petri dish, our little example. We're going to talk about that, how all of these things that we've kind of talked about today, how they will then play out practically. Then we're going to talk about anti-fans.
This
is one of the things, this is going to be in its own episode, and this is one of the things that we left out, really. We talked about it. I don't think it had developed, but I don't think it had developed to the level it is now.
To the extreme.
It's very extreme. And subsequent to being involved in, subsequent to recording the first episode, I then became deeper involved with what I think we would have to call anti-fans.
Yeah.
And they
might be the most interesting of all.
And they are the most interesting. So we're going to actually have an anti-fan appear on the show. We're going to have an anti-fan and we're going to have somebody who was a fan who has now kind of fallen away from being a fan, but is still existing in the universe.
Yeah.
And has an interest in seeing at this point kind of how the story might end. There are a lot of people like that who aren't fans. They aren't people that are anti-fans,
but
really.
But the drama, the narrative of the drama is interesting now.
It's nothing really to do with, and this is where Jane talked about how confusing fandom gets because you don't know who's who always. At this point, there are people like me, like some other people that we're going to talk to on the podcast, who are much more interested in the fandom.
Yeah.
Than they are in
the object of the fandom.
So it's not that they hate Will or they are mean to Will. It's that they are just fascinated by how the fandom itself works. Yeah. And it's very much like a reality series. So the fandom itself has become a form of media that people are now interacting with and consuming.
So that, and I think that's kind of pretty much where you are, right?
Exactly.
You've always been, well, honestly, you've always
I've kind of
really
always been there.
Yeah. You've always just been like,
with a couple of exceptions.
Fandom is fascinating, and I'm going to watch it and see what happens.
I'm going to watch it, but there were a couple of points where I did engage, and it was because people were doing things that I just found to be, like, I couldn't stand by and watch some of it happen.
Well, you couldn't just let horrible people be horrible,
right? Our opinion is that they're horrible. We'll lay it out.
Wrong about something like that.
All right. But then another episode after that is going to be looking at how the internet functions in all of this and where is it good and where is it bad. We've wanted to talk about internet for a while now. And I think that this is going to be an interesting way for us.
Is that
to
where they have
it.
The World Wide Web?
Mm-hmm.
Is that one?
The internet.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll look at ways that people are communicating, like on Reddit and on
CompuServe.
Twitter.
CompuServe.
No.
AOL,
Reddit
chat rooms.
And Twitter, which is now X, stupidest name ever.
I'm never going to call it X. So give it up, Elon.
All right, so let's wrap this up.
Okay. I'm excited to see where this series goes.
Yeah. This one is, again, a little bit more lectury, but next episode is going to get much more conversational.
I'm going to turn myself loose.
We're going to have a lot more to say about sort of what we've seen in the Wilverse and all of that. So, all right. If you like us, thank you very much. Please share us with a friend. We have a Twitter or X. I am at Christina Gen X. I'm also that on Blue Sky. Mark is Mark Eats Peach on Twitter, X, and he is Mark Sned on Blue Sky. We have a Twitter page for our podcast, which is at Extemporaneous2. And I'm going to say bye.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.